From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Basketball on this edition of Fresh Air. First, a talk with Hall of Famer Walt Frazier. In his 13 years in the NBA, Frazier led the New York Knicks to 2 world championships. He's written a book about one of those championship seasons and his life in basketball. Then a look at college basketball with sports writer John Feinstein. His first book, A Season on the Brink, A Year with Bobby Knight and the Indiana Hoosiers, became the best-selling hardcover sports book ever. His new book, A Season Inside, is a journal of a college basketball season. Pianist Harry Connick Jr. returns in our weekly performance spot. And critic Ken Tucker reviews the home video release of 5 Easy Pieces, starring Jack Nicholson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Walt Frazier was one of the early superstars of the National Basketball Association and one of the outstanding guards in basketball history. For 10 years, he played for the New York Knicks, a team that built their game around defense. The Knicks won their first NBA championship in 1970. That season, Frazier was voted best defensive player by the NBA and ranked 2nd in scoring. Off the court, Frazier was a cool man about town, sporting a black mink coat, driving a pink Eldorado. Frazier was traded to Cleveland in 1977 and retired from basketball shortly after. Now he's back in the game as a commentator for the Madison Square Garden cable network. Last year, Frazier was inducted into the Hall of Fame. Walt Frazier has just written a memoir about the 1969-70 championship season. It's called Walt Frazier, One Magic Season and a Basketball Life, and it's co-authored with Neil Offen. Frazier might have become a football player. He was offered a football college scholarship, but he turned it down.
I wasn't that fast, and not being a pioneer, because in those days there were no black quarterbacks in the NFL, so I assumed my best chance to make it to the professional ranks would be as a basketball player.
So you knew you'd stand a better chance of making it in basketball?
Yes.
You joined the New York Knicks in 1967, and I think it was in the middle of that season that Red Holtzman became the coach. You really liked him right off, and one of the things you liked him for was being tough. In what ways was he tougher on the players than the coach that preceded him?
Well, he was tough in that there was only one set of rules for the superstars, and there was only one set of rules for the rookies. So I admired that, because he didn't play favorites. Everybody had to abide by the rules, and that's what I was accustomed to throughout my career. And I like rules and regulations. I like a structured system of discipline. So when Holtzman took over, that was his philosophy, and I strived under that principle. He instilled a lot of confidence in me, and he also came in with the tough defense assignments that the Knicks would pick up guys all over the floor and pressure them, and that was my thing, being a good defensive player. So that enabled me to get more playing time, and by doing that, I gained my confidence, and you know, the rest is history. I became a superstar player.
Was defense always your game?
Well, it's ironic how it happened. My sophomore year in college, I was very successful, and I got the big head. I didn't go to class, so I became ineligible. So the next season that I did not play, the coach made me play defense every day, sort of as a punishment for not making grades. And one day I decided that if I'm going to play defense, I'm going to be the best defensive player there is. So I perfected my skills in mastering the fundamentals of defense, see the ball, see your man. I really got into perfecting my stance, which is a staggered stance that you play on defense. And that whole season, like I said, I just played defense, so I began to like it.
When you were playing with the Knicks, how would you psych out the person you were guarding?
Mainly, at times, I would psych them out by allowing them early on in the game to get away with certain things when I knew that I could steal the ball. But if you stole a ball, say, in the first half, it doesn't mean anything because the guys get over it. But if you steal the ball, say, in the last 5 minutes or at a crucial time in the fourth quarter, it can turn the game around. So that's how I really psych guys, in that I would let them do things early on in the game, setting them up for that key time in the fourth quarter when the steal would mean something, and then I would make it.
You were a great stealer.
I attribute that to, I often tell people, when you grow up in a large family like I did, I have seven sisters and one brother, it helps to have quick hands.
Well, they weren't keeping statistics on stealing when you were playing, but there are statistics on that now. Do you think that stealing is key to a good defense?
No, but it can be very devastating. Today you see very few steals because the advent of defense is not as prevalent when I play. Defense is becoming somewhat of a lost art in today's game because everything is predicated on offense and showtime and dunk shots. So the fans of this era would like to see more exciting basketball. They're not into defense. But a defense, when you can steal the ball from a professional player, it's very devastating, and the crowd used to love it when I did it at Madison Square Garden.
Now, what kind of opening would you look for to know that you could steal a ball?
Whenever a person dribbles the ball, you should always protect the ball with your body. But like I said, I would set guys up so they would get comfortable in having the ball out in front of them. And when you do that, then you're vulnerable to a steal. Another thing I would do is that I always made my steals from when a player was dribbling from left to right, because then I could tap the ball away from him without my body making contact to draw a foul.
Mm-hmm. Walt Frazier is my guest. He was one of the star players of the Knicks. He's written a new autobiography called Walt Frazier, One Magic Season and a Basketball Life. Now, another thing that you became really famous for was kind of thriving under pressure. You tell a great story in your book about scoring the winning points in foul shots with 2 seconds left in the game that broke a record for winning streaks. You won 18 games in a row. And so you were the one who scored the winning points for that. What went through your mind when you were making those foul shots with 2 seconds left? You had three chances, and you knew you had to make it.
Well, what happened was I made a steal late in the game, and in attempting to shoot the ball, I was fouled. So I was knocked to the floor. There was like 1 second left on the clock. And I looked up and I said, God, why didn't that ball go in? Because I realized now I must go to the line and make these shots. So, of course, I was supposed to be a cool guy, you know, so I go up to the line very cool. But inside, I'm dying, you know what I'm saying? Come on, God, please help me out of this. Because I know if I don't make these shots, there's no way that I can go in our locker room after the game. So the first one, I'm very cool, and I shoot it, and it goes in. So then I knew the worst thing that could happen is that the game would be tied because I've tied the score. And I still had two more shots. And, of course, I sank the second one, you know, and I looked very cool. Like, hey, this was easy. There was no pressure on me at all.
When you're standing there and it's time to shoot the foul shot, do you give yourself a few seconds to think first? And do you know when it's time to actually make the shot?
Yeah, well, you take a deep breath and try to relax. But what happened in that game, the other team called a timeout to, like, psych me. So they called timeout just before I was to shoot my fouls just so I could go to the bench and think about it, you know. So I went up there and I just, you know, take a few deep breaths and, like, shake your fingers, try to get the tension out of your shoulders, and then you go to the basics. The basics of shooting a free throw is you shoot for the front or the back of the rim. You try to follow through, and you bend your knees. So I just ran that through my mind, like, okay, Clyde, you got to do the basics. Just go back, take your time, relax, concentrate.
You said that if you missed these shots, you knew you wouldn't be able to go into the Knicks locker room.
Right.
But really, I'm sure you had been in that position where you blew a shot at some time in your career. What is it like when you go into the locker room and you helped lose a game?
It's quiet. There's silence. No one looks at you. A few people will pat you on the back, but you know they're just trying to help you out. And inside, you feel terrible. And, of course, the coach would come over and say, we'll get them next time. And some of the other guys will give you encouragement. But that doesn't help the pain at that time. It's very excruciating when you know that you blew the game. And in this situation, with an 18-game winning streak on the line, that's why it was so monumental. Like, I didn't want to be the guy to break the string in this way.
Mm-hmm. Did you used to get superstitious when you were on a winning streak?
No question. Excuse me. During that time, everybody did everything the same way. We all dressed the same way. We stayed in the same locker, put our shoes on, and different guys went out at the same time, and the coach wore the same tie and shirt. So we became very superstitious during that winning streak.
You're how tall, around 6'4"?
Yes.
When you were playing, that was, I guess, more or less an average height. I think the height's gotten a lot taller now in basketball. You describe the first time you met Lou Alcindor and how tall he seemed and how uncomfortable he was in your car and how awkward he seemed about his height. Height seems to have really changed a lot in the game.
Today, the average height is 6'7" for an NBA player, and that's one of the noticeable changes in the game, that the guys are so much bigger, stronger, and faster. And they can do the same things that I did at a shorter height. So it's really incredible when I watch these guys to see them perform today.
You say in your book you're glad you're not playing now.
Well, I think there's less discipline. Like I said, I like a structured system. I like to play defense. I like a team-oriented game. And today that's somewhat lacking.
How did you get the nickname of Clyde?
Clyde is my fashion image. If you saw the movie Bonnie and Clyde, I started out wearing those wide-brim hats like Clyde and the two-tone shoes and the double-breasted suits. And I wore fur coats and a Rolls Royce, so they started to call me Clyde as soon as the movie came out, and I was dressing that way.
Do you still dress that way?
Occasionally. I think with age, Clyde kind of faded into the background. That was a fun time in my life, and my philosophy was, whenever you saw me dressed up, I played the way that I looked. And during those days, we were playing well, so I was always dressed up, going out on the town. Now that I'm older, I still have the robes and I have the mink coats, but they don't mean the same. I'm not into materialistic things like I used to be. So in those days, I would never go anywhere unless I went up in my Rolls Royce. And today, I showed up in a cab. So, you know, I've changed quite a bit.
I notice that you still think of yourself as Clyde, because before you were saying, I said to myself, Clyde.
Yeah, Clyde is, I think everyone has two different personalities. Okay, Walt Frazier is a very quiet and shy person, which basically I am all the time. Clyde was a guy that liked the limelight, and he seeked the limelight. And he would usually come on around 12 a.m. I would start hitting the spots in New York, and I like to go out and mingle with my fans, and I like to go dancing with pretty girls and, you know, just have a good time, and that's what I was into. But I never did that when the Knicks were losing, because it wasn't the same. I always realized and understood that I was in New York to win basketball games, and when I wasn't winning, the music didn't sound as good, and I didn't like to dress up, and I just stayed home.
Do people give you free drinks when you're not winning?
There was a period in New York for 5 years that I could not spend any money. I would go to a restaurant, and when the meal was over, I would attempt to pay, and they say, it's okay, somebody paid for it, or they were constantly sending champagne over to my table. And even today, now that the Knicks are coming back into prominence, just the other day I was down buying a paper, and the lady goes, that's okay, you don't have to pay for it. So whenever New York teams are winning, that's the beauty of playing in New York, that you get a lot of things carte blanche.
And when you're losing?
Well, when you're losing, you must pay. But I think that's fair. I think, well, I don't necessarily say people should give us things, but I think in New York, when you're winning, they give you the town, and when you're losing, they're tough on you. So I think it's fair. Whereas most players think that New York isn't a good place to play because the people are so critical. But they don't realize, or they don't look at it the way that I do. But when you win in New York, you're on every magazine cover throughout the country. People really know you. So I think it's only right that when you don't perform up to standard, that they should criticize you.
In your memoir, you write that whenever it was convenient, you had sex, but not the night before games.
Well, I try to display discipline. And one incident in high school got me that way. One time I walked my girlfriend home, which was about 2 or 3 miles after school, and we had a game that night, so I had to walk back. And that game I played terrible, and we lost. And I never forgave myself for letting the team down. Like, my legs were so tired from all the walking. So after that time, I never associated, you know, with women or anything before a game, like having sex or just out having a good time. I always go home and I get my rest.
You got a divorce while you were playing with the Knicks, and I think that you said you'd never remarry while you were still playing basketball because there were too many temptations.
There were too many temptations, and I'm too moody. Like I said, when we're winning, I'm a nice guy to get along with, but when we're losing, I go and I become a recluse. I don't go out. I don't talk to people. And I didn't want to subject anybody to my moodiness.
You were traded. When you were 32 years old, you were traded to Cleveland. And the coach at that time was one of your former teammates, Willis Reed. Were you really angry when you were traded?
I was very disappointed because I wanted to end my career in New York, and I'd never thought about being traded. I mean, I'd played 10 years for the Knicks, and my name was synonymous with the New York Knicks. And the other exasperating part of it was that my former teammate traded me, and he did not tell me. I had to find out from my agent that I had been traded, so it was devastating in that respect, that someone that you played with and you had so many good times with, that they didn't have the courtesy to come up and tell you that you'd been traded.
You considered retiring instead of moving.
Yeah, like I said, the devastation of it, I said, well, I guess I'll retire. But after 3 or 4 days of getting over the initial shock and looking at Cleveland on paper, that was the best team that, you know, I could possibly go into. They needed a player of my caliber. So I went to Cleveland.
How were you changed by playing for Cleveland?
It was a dramatic change in my life because I was no longer Clyde. Cleveland is not New York, and when there's 10 inches of snow on the ground, there's no place that I want to go. So I became a homebody, and I started to do things I never did in New York, like sit in my living room and read a book or play backgammon. I became Walt again, the quiet, shy guy. And I realized that I only had 2 more years to play, so I started to read a lot of self-help books, things that could help me try to smooth the transition when I was no longer a player.
You say it's hard to get old in a young man's game, and for a lot of players after they turn 30, the younger players look at them like they're old men. Did you start to feel that way at any point in your career?
I did. The fun part of the game was gone for me. It became a job. I dreaded practice. I dreaded going to the games. And that was something that I'd never felt. Like, throughout my career, I enjoyed working out. I mean, I loved basketball. I loved working out, being, you know, the camaraderie with the players. And that was missing in Cleveland. I just didn't have it, and I knew it was time to go.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your life, but first we're going to take a short break. Basketball Hall of Famer Walt Frazier is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Basketball Hall of Famer Walt Frazier is my guest. He played with the Knicks for 10 years, joined the team in 67, and became one of the star players. He's just written a memoir called Walt Frazier, One Magic Season and a Basketball Life. Let's talk about growing up a little bit and how you learned the game. Did you learn the game in schoolyards?
Yes. As a youngster, I was always on the playground. If you ever went to my house and asked my mother where was I, she would say, go down to the playground. He's down there. Because from sun up to sundown, that's what all the kids in the neighborhood would do. And basketball season was basketball, and baseball season, baseball, football. If it rained, we played checkers or Scrabbles or Pollyanna or some of the other games. So our whole life was sports, and all the kids were on the playground. And that's where I developed my game, from playing the other kids in the neighborhood. And, of course, I was considered one of the top players, you know, in the area. But my thing was, most of the older guys took me under their wing. Like, they would never let me get in any trouble. And in those days, trouble was smoking a cigarette or trying to shoot dice. They would always run me home because they said, you're going to be an athlete, so you can't do this stuff. So those guys constantly kept me out of trouble, and they just helped me perfect my skills in the sports area.
Well, your father, you say, controlled some of the numbers in Atlanta, where you lived. Was he a good example in that sense of not getting into trouble?
Well, at that time, I was too young to know. I didn't know about that. So my father never actually taught me sports, anything like that. He would buy me tickets to go to the games and things, but he never actually participated with me.
When you were growing up in Georgia, you played on segregated teams?
Yes.
Was it difficult to really measure how good you were when you couldn't play against all the athletes in your city or all the athletes in the high schools?
Yeah, indeed it was, because when I read the paper, say the Atlanta Constitution, which was the local white paper, I never saw my name because they never covered our game. So I assumed that those guys that I read about was better than I was. So I never thought I would be a professional player because of that. No one ever really scouted us except the other black schools. So you assume that you're sort of inferior as an athlete. And, you know, you don't think you have a chance really to make it to the big time.
So college was the first time you played on an integrated team?
Yes. Yeah, college was the first time I'd ever been around white people at all, other than seeing them in a grocery store. You know, at that time we had to ride the back of the bus and we had separate water fountains and that type of thing. So I didn't have any communication with white people until I went to college.
Was it a conscious choice to go to an integrated college as opposed to one of the black colleges?
Well, my parents talked me into doing that because they felt I would get a better education. And, of course, I was petrified. I was saying, wow, you know, I didn't feel comfortable around white people naturally because I'd never been around them. And the other thing I found, that I was so far behind academically. Certain things that they took for granted, like math and English and speaking in front of the class, I'd never had. So I was really lost in my classes. And only once basketball season started and people started to know me and then I started to get tutors that I hung on. But there were many nights that I cried and I wanted to go home.
Well, you're right that you actually thought about dropping out. And I thought this was interesting. You went back to your old neighborhood and you saw some of the good basketball players, some of the older players had just been hanging around and putting on weight, and that really depressed you and kind of scared you.
Right, because I didn't want to end up like them. And, you know, at first, my freshman year, I admired those guys because they had all the big cars and they were dressing fine and they had all the girls. And I can recall when I came home from the summer to work, I wouldn't go out. My mother used to tell me, why don't you go out? You know, you get outside and get some air. And I was, like, embarrassed because these guys had all the nice clothes and I was still wearing button-down shirts like college stuff and penny loafers, and these guys were having alligator shoes on. So I wouldn't go out, but I would work like 12 hours a day at this place just to make money to go back to school. So when I was thinking about leaving college and I went back, I saw these same guys. They no longer had that money. They were, a lot of them were alcoholics and into drugs. A lot of my friends were dead or in jail. So I said, hey, I don't want this. I better go back to school someplace.
It's interesting. Your son plays basketball for the University of Pennsylvania now, an Ivy League school.
Yeah, it is, and I'm very proud of him. I don't think he has NBA talent, but I prefer that he's a good student like he is because I know his future would be secure if he graduates from Penn, which he will next year. So it's something I'm very proud of. But he desperately wants to be an NBA player. And like all kids growing up, unfortunately, I didn't grow up with him because I was separated from his mother right after college. But I used to keep him during the summer, and I tried to stress to him the importance of health and diet because he was always a chunky kid. He liked to eat too much, so I tried to talk to him about the proper diet. And being motivated, like trying to instill in him what you want to do, you have to work hard to do it. You can't take a break. So I can recall when I used to go to his room, I was still playing, so I used to jog religiously every day. So I would knock on his door, Walt, would you want to jog? He goes, nah, man, I'm on vacation. You know, meaning that school was out and he didn't see any need to be practicing because basketball season was like 2 or 3 months away. So I tried to explain to him about the kids in Harlem and all the other players that will make it to the NBA. They pay a certain price. And now he's realizing what I meant because he sees that he's a step slow because he didn't work on his diet and that he didn't work hard enough to develop his quickness.
Walt Frazier is my guest. You are, I think, among the first generation of basketball players to earn a lot of money and to really become celebrities. A lot of people didn't know what to do with their money and spent it all or squandered it in some way. Especially, you know, if you go from poverty to wealth, you don't really know how to manage money. What did you do? Did you get someone to invest for you to handle your money?
Well, I was lucky. I squandered a lot on clothes and But basically, that was my only vice, was buying clothes, because I didn't smoke, I didn't drink. And the rest of it, I used to take care of my brothers and sisters and my mother to make them comfortable. And I made mistakes as well, but I rebounded from them. I mean, I had unscrupulous people dealing with my monies at times, and I made some losses, but I rebounded. So I've been fortunate in that respect. A lot of our players are broke because part of it is their fault, because they live a high life. They live a high standard with drugs and buying a lot of fancy material things. And then, of course, they get ripped off by agents or whatever. And I found that I'm making money now because of my reputation, by being a good person and not being involved with drugs, being concerned about our youth. As a player, I was always into kids and trying to help them, so people are willing to help me now, and that has paid off for me. But basically, I was just a lucky person in that, you know, I made big bucks. I went through a lot of things that other players did, but I came out on top.
Did you undergo any kind of crisis when you retired from basketball, figuring out what to do next?
I did. That was a 2-year period where I didn't know what to do right after I retired from the game, and I was just lost. I went into the agent business representing other players, and I saw there was no future in that because the guys are not loyal, they're not thankful. Luckily, I started to work for the Knicks, Madison Square Garden Network, and announcing the games, and from that, the Atlanta Hawks hired me as an analyst, and then the book with which I'm promoting now came along. So all of these things just started happening for me, good things. But I think it was brought on by my belief in God. Like there was a big void that I had to fill, and I got back into the church, and my life seemed to start on an upswing. You know, I started to become more giving and open and helping, more concerned about other people than myself. You know, I often tell my friends I'm more of a philanthropist now than a philanderer. So my life changed again. Like, I saw this big change in me, and that I really want to help other people, and especially kids. And today, a lot of my times I go into high schools and colleges talking about the importance of education and say no to drugs.
In your book, you wrote that after you retired from basketball, it took about 2 years before you could watch basketball on TV. I guess that was in part because you missed it, or at least were ambivalent about not playing. What about now? Do you watch it now?
Yeah, well, there was a time when I didn't watch it, but I find that's common with all athletes. I was just reading an article about Tracy Austin and Andrew Yeager, you know, the two ex-tennis players. And they said the same thing. They said once they were injured, they couldn't watch tennis. They didn't watch it at all. So I find that to be true with all players, that once they leave the game for some strange reason, I don't think that I was bitter towards basketball why I didn't watch it. I don't know. Maybe I was inside and didn't realize it. But I would not watch a game for those 2 years. Now I have to, because it's my occupation. I mean, I have to be aware of the games.
Of course, yeah. Of course.
But prior to that, I would read it in the paper. You know, I kept abreast of, basically, I knew all the superstars. I didn't know all the different rosters like I know today. But I would watch it. But basically, the last 5 minutes of a game was the only part of the game that I could get interested in.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us about basketball and about your life. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Walt Frazier, and he was named to the Basketball Hall of Fame in 1987. He now operates a summer basketball camp on Staten Island and does commentary and analysis for New York Knicks basketball on the Madison Square Garden cable network. His new book, Walt Frazier, One Magic Season and a Basketball Life, is published by Times Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with journalist Taylor Branch. His new book, Parting the Waters, is about America during the Civil Rights Movement. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Sports writer John Feinstein had a surprise bestseller with his first book, A Season on the Brink, A Year with Bobby Knight and the Indiana Hoosiers. It profiled one of college basketball's most controversial coaches. Coming up, we talk about his new book, A Season Inside, A Journal of a Year in College Basketball. Also, our performer in residence, New Orleans pianist Harry Connick Jr., puts his own spin on the song Goody Goody. Five Easy Pieces starring Jack Nicholson recently came out on home video, and critic Ken Tucker has some comments on how well the movie holds up. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. Five hijackers today surrendered to Israeli authorities at Tel Aviv's Ben-Gurion International Airport. It was the conclusion of a drama that began yesterday in the Soviet Union. NPR's John Hockenberry reports.
It was a hostage drama with something of a Marx Brothers subtext. The five hijackers aboard a commandeered Soviet plane were brought to Israel, where they promptly released hostages, surrendered their weapons, and gave themselves up on condition that they be allowed to carry with them to jail their bags of stolen rubles they said were worth $2 million. Even rubles that are not stolen are difficult to spend anywhere besides Russia or Eastern Europe, so the intentions of the hijackers are shrouded a bit in mystery tonight. Israel is considering an extradition request from the Soviet Union. Yesterday, the hijackers attacked a bus full of school children, got the Soviets to give them an airplane, released the children in the Soviet Union, and set off for some destination. They had asked to go to South Africa, Pakistan, Egypt, or Israel. When they arrived in Israel, officials said one of the hijackers demanded that they be shown a Star of David or hear someone speak Yiddish to prove where they had landed. I'm John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
The United Nations General Assembly today voted to move its debate on Palestine to Geneva because of the U.S. refusal to allow PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat to enter the United States. The vote was 154-2. Only Israel joined the United States in voting against the resolution. Great Britain abstained. The resolution deplored the American rejection of the U.N.'s appeal to grant Arafat a visa so he could address the General Assembly in New York. Some 300 rebel troops have taken control of Argentina's largest military base. The troops are rejecting the leadership of the base commander of the Campo de Mayo facility and backing a right-wing colonel. There have been reports of rifle and mortar fire at the base. Earlier, loyal troops quelled a raid on a military prison. It's the third time Army troops have rebelled in 2 years. After a day's delay, the space shuttle Atlantis blasted off this morning from the Kennedy Space Center on a secret mission. We get details from NPR's Richard Harris.
High winds almost thwarted the space shuttle launch for the second day in a row. But with just a few minutes left in the launch window, NASA declared that the weather had improved and the countdown clock rolled forward. Instead of heading east, as shuttles usually do, the shuttle headed on a northerly course. That orbit will take the shuttle over about 80% of the Soviet Union, and that's exactly what the experts had predicted. Atlantis is on a secret mission, but it's said to be carrying a satellite to spy on the Soviet military. We won't hear anything more than scanty status reports on the mission until some undisclosed time next week, when the shuttle heads toward the landing strip at Edwards Air Force Base in California. This is Richard Harris at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
In Dallas, a state judge today recommended a new trial for a man whose murder conviction had been questioned in the movie docudrama The Thin Blue Line. The judge said he will tell the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals that Randall Dale Adams deserves a new trial. Adams has served 12 years in prison for the shooting of Officer Robert Wood in 1976. He said he did not commit the crime. Much of the material being presented in the retrial hearing this week was in the docudrama, which raised charges that witnesses in the original trial had lied. Unemployment rose slightly last month. The Labor Department said today that joblessness was up 0.1% to 5.4%. Despite the slight increase in the unemployment rate, 116 million Americans held jobs last month, or more than 62% of the adult population. Four bombs exploded today in Athens, just hours before leaders of the European Economic Community opened a summit on East-West relations in another part of Greece. No one was injured in the blasts, which went off prior to the EEC's meeting on the island of Rhodes. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Today we say goodbye to our performer-in-residence, pianist and singer Harry Connick Jr. For the past several weeks, Connick has played music inspired by the New Orleans pianists he grew up listening to and other jazz musicians who have influenced his playing, including Thelonious Monk.
Monk did things on the piano that no pianist prior to him did quite like he did. His biggest influence was probably Duke Ellington. And Duke Ellington was one of the first people to really bring the American sound out of a piano as opposed to a European influence kind of sound. And what Monk did, as opposed to dealing with a lot of virtuosity, which basically implies speed, he would play things that were very, well, this is only one level of it, but he would play things that were incredibly technically difficult, meaning like his sound was incredibly big. Thelonious Monk has been an incredible influence on my piano playing and on my general music concept. Monk did a lot of things that were unique. He built on what Duke Ellington did harmonically and rhythmically, and among other people as well that he had for influences. But some of the things that he did that I find really interesting are, for instance, when he would play the time, which is like with his left hand, as opposed to playing on every beat, like, say, Errol Garner would do. As opposed to playing on every beat, what he would do would be to leave out certain notes. The way he employed space was totally unique. So as he would take his left hand and play something like this. So the tune would be swinging, but he would, and you wouldn't really miss the notes that he wouldn't play. When he played in his right hand, as opposed to doing a fast Tatum-esque run, what he would do would be to not play as many notes, but the notes that he chose were quite appropriate. He would do things like this. People say, well, Monk didn't have a lot of technique. Well, Monk played like an American pianist would play. And the notes that he played were perfect. His solos were incredibly logical and thematic, and he was just a genius. And what I'm going to do now is something I don't think has ever been done before. I'm going to take a tune that Johnny Mercer wrote the lyrics to and play it in a Monk kind of style. I don't know how it's going to come out, but we'll see if Johnny and Monk get along on Goody Goody.
You met someone who set you back on your heel. Goody, goody. You met someone and now you know how it feels. Goody, goody. You gave him your heart too, but just like I gave mine to you. And it broke it up in little pieces. Now how do you do? Well, you sit up late, crying a blues all night. Goody, goody, you must think love's a barrel of dynamite. Hooray and hallelujah, I knew you had it coming to ya. Yes, goody, goody for him. Goody, goody for me. And I hope you're satisfied, you rascal, you. Go ahead, Monk. Thank you. night that blew your big fat head off. Hooray and hallelujah, I knew you had it coming to you. Goody, goody for him. Goody, goody for me. And darling, I hope you're satisfied, you rascal, you.
Harry Connick Jr. has two albums on Columbia Records. His new one is called 20. This is Fresh Air. Sports writer John Feinstein points out that one of the things that makes college basketball different from the pro game is that no player stays longer than 4 years. The names and faces always change, but Feinstein's interest in the game remains constant. His first book, A Season on the Brink, was a surprise bestseller about Bobby Knight, one of the most controversial coaches in college basketball. In Feinstein's new book, A Season Inside, he tries to explain the culture that surrounds the game. He crisscrossed the country, attending 104 college games during the 1987-88 season, interviewing players, coaches, and referees. Feinstein covered basketball and other sports for 11 years for the Washington Post and recently joined the staff of Sports Illustrated. Feinstein told me why he finds college basketball more interesting than professional basketball.
I think when you factor in atmosphere, intensity, games meaning something, the fact that college basketball is played during what I think should be the basketball season, which is the winter time. The pros play their most important games in the middle of the summer nowadays. I think when you factor all those things in, the college game is a better game. I can't think of anything better on a winter night than to be in a college gym where the place is rocking, the fans are really into it because every game is important because the colleges only play 30 games, and everybody is really intense about what's going on the court. In the pro game, most of the games you see, the places are half full, the gyms are quiet, and half the time the players don't really care what's going on until you get to the playoffs in April and May.
I have a friend who likes to say that if you want to see great players, watch the NBA games, but if you want to watch coaches suffer, watch college basketball.
Well, there's no question that coaches are the rock stars of college sports, basketball coaches. You can't really tell one football coach from another. They all look alike and they all sound alike, and they're all so far away when you're at a game anyway. You can't tell who's who. They're all dressed alike, too. But college basketball coaches are very distinct personalities, whether you're talking about Bob Knight or John Thompson or some of the guys who I followed closely in A Season Inside, like Rolly Massimino at Villanova, or Paul Evans at Pittsburgh, who the only thing they have in common is that they're both excellent coaches, but they're as different as two men can possibly be, and that may be part of the reason why there's a problem between the two of them. They don't get along at all. And then you have guys like Jim Valvano down at NC State who really want what his ambition in life really is to replace Johnny Carson.
Why have coaches become the stars of college basketball?
I think it has to do with a number of things. One is the intimacy. When you are at a college game, they are the guys you notice. They're the ones always jump. First of all, assistants can't get off the bench. So the only guy you ever see jumping off the bench is the head coach. And so you can't help but notice him. And if it's John Thompson, how can you miss a guy who's 6'10" and weighs 300 pounds? If it's Dean Smith, he's going to be the only guy in the building in French cuffs. If it's Rolly Massimino, he's going to be the only guy whose suit is falling apart during the game.
While we're talking about coaches, you, of course, wrote the best-selling book about Bobby Knight. And I was wondering if your book about him improved your access to other coaches and players when you were taking your tour of one basketball season, or whether it hurt you in any way.
Most of them reacted very positively because basketball people, when they read A Season on the Brink, even though Knight didn't like it, basketball people reading it felt that it was fair and that it was an accurate reflection of the way Knight is. So when I would approach a Gene Katie at Purdue or Lou Dolson to ask if Steve Kerr could be involved in the project or Danny Manning and Larry Brown at Kansas, they all seemed to feel that since I had treated Knight fairly, that I would treat them fairly. And they were very open to giving me that kind of access that I had with Knight, getting into their locker rooms and their meetings and talking quite frankly to me about what was going on inside their teams during the season.
Well, Knight says that he didn't like your book and that one of the reasons why was that there was too much profanity in it, that you quoted you quoted all of his profanity. What were your reactions to his reaction to your book?
Well, one thing, and I don't think there'd be any dispute on this, I didn't quote all his profanity because if I had, the book would have been longer than War and Peace and War and Remembrance combined. But he somehow felt that I was going to leave all of his profanity out, and I had told him that for the book to be an accurate reflection of who he is, profanity had to be included because that's a part of his personality, a major part of it. But my reaction to his not liking the book was to write him and say, I'm sorry you don't like this because the access you gave me makes the book what it is. But I wouldn't change a word of it because I think it is what we set out to do, which was give people an idea of what it was like to live through a season with him.
It seems that the part of the season most universally hated by coaches is recruiting. You quote Jim Valvano as saying, if you're a decent human being on any level, you must hate what we do in recruiting.
Right. I think that if there's one thing all coaches agree on, it's that if they never had to recruit again, they would be very happy. Recruiting is something that is inherently dishonest. You are selling a product. You are telling kids that they are great, perfect, and wonderful, knowing full well that if they do come to your school, the minute they're enrolled as freshmen, you're going to start telling them they're terrible, they can't play, and if they don't listen to you, they're never going to get better. So there's a certain hypocrisy in that. I made home visits with a number of coaches, and I think the most honest coach I saw in action during a home visit was Dale Brown, who sat in a youngster's living room and said, you know, if I was really as good a person as I'm claiming to you that I am, I wouldn't be here tonight. I'd be out working for Mother Teresa. And he went on to say, I'm sitting here in New Jersey today telling you why it would be great for you to go to school in Louisiana, that your parents can get there by airplane very quickly, that it's no problem. Tomorrow I'm going to be in Baton Rouge and I'll be telling kids from Louisiana why they should stay home and be close to their families.
Now, the colleges are in a kind of funny situation. Do they admit that they're making lots of money from their star basketball players and treat them differently, therefore, from other students? Or do they try to treat the basketball stars as if they were just regular students and not acknowledge how much cash they're making from the teams?
Well, they admit that athletes are different by the very fact that they admit athletes to their school who would normally not get in. I mean, whether you're talking about Harvard mm-hmm. or Oklahoma State, the average board score or the average grade point average of the athletes, whether they be football or basketball players, those are the two revenue sports, are much lower than the average student. I mean, to get into a school let's take Duke, for example, which is the number one ranked basketball team in the nation right now, basketball. The average board score at Duke is somewhere in the 1200s, but basketball players can get in with board scores as low as 800. And Duke is one of the schools that has relatively high academic standards for athletes. And yet, they will admit basketball players who score over 400 points lower than the average because they're athletes.
You know, one of the coaches who you spoke to in the book described college basketball as a culture all its own. And I was wondering how close you think sports writers actually get into the culture.
I think it depends on the sports writer. I think the very best of them can do it, can make people explain that the good side of college basketball is more than just a game, to coin a phrase. But I think that when you see people like Steve Kerr, who come back from the assassination of his father when he was a freshman, his dad was assassinated by the PLO, and rebound from that to become a folk hero in the whole state of Arizona. And you see even like the three seniors at Purdue who ended their careers very disappointingly because they'd had such a great season, but they were upset in the round of 16. But they walked away from it saying, you know, we had a lot of fights with Coach Katie over the years, but even though we lost, we figured out before it was over that what he was doing was right and that he had the experience and he knew what was best for us. Or you spend a night in the Palestra in Philadelphia, and the place just reeks of history. It's been there for 61 years now, and every team that ever mattered has played there. And you can feel that history when you're there. And the writers who really love the game and who understand the game and who I think most important understand the people in the game are the ones who can add that extra dimension to their writing. And what I tried to do in this book was to give people an idea of what the people in the game are like, what a Don DeVoe at Tennessee is like fighting to save his job as opposed to a Rick Barnes, a first-year coach at George Mason, fighting to learn his job. And that's what I tried to do throughout the entire book.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
John Feinstein's new book, A Season Inside, is published by Villard Books. This is Fresh Air. In films like Chinatown, Easy Rider, Terms of Endearment, and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Jack Nicholson has made a name for him.
Well, there was a hijacking, as you may know, in the Soviet Union. A cargo plane flown to Israel. We'll have a report from Israel on what's happened when the plane arrived. We'll consider the value of advice. Vice President Bush is getting quite a lot of it these days about how he should begin to be president. But as NPR's Cokie Roberts is going to report, the value of this advice often is a matter of timing. And a conversation with a San Diego law enforcement official who is worried about how to stop the death of immigrants sneaking across the border and being run down by accident along a border highway.
Thanks, Alex. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
In films like Chinatown, Easy Rider, Terms of Endearment, and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Jack Nicholson has made a name for himself playing characters who defy conventional behavior. One of Nicholson's classic roles was in Five Easy Pieces. The movie's now available on home video. Critic Ken Tucker has a review.
The recent appearance of Five Easy Pieces on video cassette provides an opportunity for us to reconsider what seems to have been one of the pop cultural touchstones of an earlier era. Five Easy Pieces, first released in 1970 and directed by Bob Rafelson, stars Jack Nicholson as Bobby, a gifted pianist, the son of a wealthy family, who chucks it all to work on an oil rig in Texas. This was the ultimate yuppie in despair fantasy before the word yuppie had even been coined. As the brooding Bobby, Nicholson's slumming is profound and steeped in class animus. He drinks enormous quantities of beer with his vulgar friends. He listens to Tammy Wynette sing Great Country Weepers. He goes bowling with the guys, and he makes time with Karen Black as the ultimate working-class floozy. It's a measure of Karen Black's skill here that she manages to transcend the cultural stereotype she's playing to become a character as sympathetic as she is sexy. Five Easy Pieces contains a number of sequences that stick in the mind, the most famous of which is Nicholson at his rudest, confronting a surly waitress in a diner.
I'd like a plain omelet, no potatoes on the plate, a cup of coffee, and a side order of wheat toast.
I'm sorry, we don't have any side orders of toast. I'll give you a English muffin or a coffee roll.
What do you mean you don't make side orders of toast? You make sandwiches, don't you? You've got bread and a toaster of some kind?
I don't make the rules.
Okay, I'll make it as easy for you as I can. I'd like an omelet, plain, and a chicken salad sandwich on wheat toast. No mayonnaise, no butter, no lettuce, and a cup of coffee.
And number two, chicken salad sand. Hold the butter, the lettuce, the mayonnaise, and a cup of coffee. Anything else?
Yeah, now all you have to do is hold the chicken, bring me the toast, give me a check for the chicken salad sandwich, and you haven't broken any rules.
You want me to hold the chicken, huh?
I want you to hold it between your knees.
There's an improvisational air to Five Easy Pieces, a feeling that anything can happen. That scene, for example, has nothing to do really with the rest of the film, but it does serve to illustrate Bobby's stubbornness, his alienation and disdain. Jack Nicholson and Bob Rafelson find existentialism in a chicken salad sandwich. In trying to convey the numbness in Jack Nicholson's soul, however, the movie itself becomes a little numbing about halfway through. Perhaps that's because Adrian Joyce's script doesn't really have anywhere to go once Nicholson's character travels home to visit his dying father and have a good long cry. By then, he's killed so many of his feelings that there's not much left for an audience to respond to. Still, Five Easy Pieces is the sort of movie that dies in a development deal these days. It's got a star at the peak of his powers taking chances with an idiosyncratic script guided by a maverick director. They just don't make them like that anymore. Let's hope that the other interesting Nicholson-Rafelson collaboration, The King of Marvin Gardens, made in 1972, also comes out on video cassette soon. As you may recall, it's the story of a depressed disc jockey's fumbling attempt to make contact with the brother he's feuded with for years. I remember it as a fascinating failure, but it would be interesting to see how it holds up now.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, the double literary life of Carolyn Heilbrunn. She's a feminist theorist and English professor, but under the pen name of Amanda Cross, she writes detective novels. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a reissue of Fred Astaire singing with a jazz sextet. And television critic David Bianculli reviews Roots, The Gift, a new ABC telemovie that revives two of the strongest characters from the miniseries Roots. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Deborah Beagle. Lisa Bruton directed today's show. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.